Hello, I'm Professor Bob Hewish from the Department of International Development Studies at Dalhousie University. You're listening to GDP, the Global Development Primer, the podcast dedicated to all issues in international development studies. Follow me on Twitter at Professor Hewish. Thanks again for joining us on the Global Development Primer podcast. And for this episode, we're joined by Evan Du, who is an executive fellow at the School of Public Policy at the University of Calgary, a sessional lecturer at the Bidis School of Business, Simon Fraser University, and a senior advisor to the China Development Research Foundation in Beijing, China. He has over 30 years of experience in international development cooperation, public policy, international trade, and public management. He has held positions with the International Development Research Center of Canada in Singapore and India, Global Affairs Canada in Ottawa, New Delhi, and Islamabad, and he served as a consultant to the United Nations and the government of Sri Lanka. He represented Canada at the OECD Development Assistance Committee and in various multilateral forums. He obtained his doctorate from the University of Sussex in the United Kingdom. And today, Evan Du is joining us to talk about some of the crucial issues around digitalization and international development. Evan, thanks so much for joining us.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you join us here. And again, you're also going to be moderating a panel coming up at a conference that'll be held at the Carleton University called Development and Cooperation, a Time of Geopolitical Instability. And that's with the Norman Patterson School of International Affairs at Carleton University. A fascinating panel that you're going to be leading there. And that I believe the date for that is going to be February 21st to the 22nd. You folks are going to be talking about a lot of issues, but of it, digitalization and international development as sort of a key issue that we're facing in the development sector today. Could you lend us some thoughts on that?
Well, certainly. Let me just back up. FIAP is the Canadian Association of International Development Professionals, and I'm a board member, but we host a conference every year, and this will be our first in-person conference since before COVID. So we're delighted to be able to gather a large number of as many people as we can. And we have some really interesting sessions, including a keynote from Bob Ray, and we should have representatives from Global Affairs Canada attending. So we're all looking forward to it. But one of the sessions that I'm critically involved in is around digitalization and international development. And, you know, as we all know, the digital economy has impacted absolutely every industry, every economy, and social life globally. So in the international development field, this is extremely important to look at much more closely. And for many years, you know, the development community has been talking about the digital divide. And I think it's perhaps more crucial now to look at this and to look at how development programs are being framed in the context of the digital economy, because the digital economy is today the economy, and data is the commodity. So it's not just a factor of production, it is the economy itself.
And it's something where there's still an incredible proportion of humanity that are still living without access to the internet. I think it was 2021. Only about half the world's population had reliable access to the internet. And that's about, 3.7 billion people without reliable access. And, you know, this, like as you hear, even in developed nations, Canada, for one, there's all sorts of motivations and programs to try to get digital access to rural communities, outlying areas, because there's such a emphasis now on relying as these services is essential, not luxury. So how is this shaping out more globally?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. It's striking in today's world to really note that nearly 3 billion people, or 2.5 billion. I think this is these are figures from the International Telecommunications Union, a UN agency, are without internet access or have not been able to benefit. Now that's changing quite rapidly as connectivity expands throughout the globe. But having said that, the digital divide is wide, and it's not actually narrowing in many respects. It's actually increasing between certainly the most marginalized and unable to capture the benefits of the digital economy and those that have it. So those are really, really critical issues. And part of this is not just on the hardware side in terms of expanding connectivity and access, but also, and I would really, say from a development angle, it's really about enhancing the right skill set to benefit from the digital economy and, be able to access financial services and to facilitate that. And also, I think what's really critical today is to ensure that, from a development angle, that digital transformation is really implemented responsibly and ethically with a view to protecting rights and security. We all know, and this just happened just within a few days ago, of just how vulnerable systems can be when global affairs went down because of a hack, and how it affected, just the workings of an entire institution within a developed country. In developing countries, the conditions are not quite as robust, and so this happens quite frequently. And so the issue of, protection, I think, is really front and center. And it's not just protection at that level. It also means in terms of as things go forward, ensuring that digital transformation is very inclusive and that there's social protection.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the things that, as you said, as this transformation is going to continue to unfold. So, I mean, you can look at the fact that we've got, well over 3 billion people who are without access. In one sense, that's an immediate tragedy. And the other side, it's a huge opportunity to get that connectivity there. But where many parts of the world have had we're getting close to almost 30, if not 40 years of kind of a slow introduction to internet technology and apps and the financing and the more connectivity that's come with it. If it just shows up overnight into a society, it can go off the rails pretty quick. And I speak to that as someone who's partially witnessed that as having visited Myanmar, where internet was so prohibited by the mid 2000s and even up to around 2014. I think it was something outstanding, like $5,000 or $6,000 US to have access to a internet capable telephone. And suddenly that $5,000 bill went down to $1 for a subscription for a year. So suddenly everybody had the internet, but with it, certain internet companies or online media firms, I should say, like Meta, just sort of came in and sort of convinced everybody that Facebook and WhatsApp was the internet. That was it. And that led to all sorts of social problems. And I think even, as you said, Mr. Ray, who led a investigation into the genocide that occurred there, sort of gave a nod to how this inundation of social media uncontrolled led to gross human rights abuses in parts of the country.
I think you're absolutely right on those points. Very often, I think in many of these countries with very limited access and so forth, the internet is recognized only through those platforms, through a Facebook platform or through another social media platform. And that's largely because in most countries, in many of these countries, it's through the mobile phones that have penetrated the most deeply. And the use of internet, especially for small businesses and so forth, have really, really, really lagged behind. But let me just come back. I mean, you just, as you were talking, it just struck me just in terms of the huge divide. And I just recall, because I had, you know, worked in Myanmar and I'd worked in Afghanistan and some of these places, you know, even today, you know, let's just take figures from ITU and just a couple years ago, where, let's say, in Afghanistan, there's only 18% of the population which have internet access. And then in much of sub-Saharan Africa, we're looking at less than 40% down to, you know, 20%, and Myanmar is down in that range as well. And then also just thinking of the small island states where connectivity is rather tenuous, it's also very low. So, I mean, those are the big challenges that I see, is to reach out to the least developed countries, which have limited connectivity, and yet can be bypassed by this massive transformation that's taking place globally, and it's disrupting every sector of the economy. So, as you were talking about Facebook and so forth, I mean, there's been huge progress in a number of areas, especially getting access to many services. I think Southeast Asia is perhaps one of the leaders in this area, and they've grown faster than any other region in the world in terms of internet usage. But that doesn't, you know, I mean, there's such a divide in other parts of the world. And even more locally, if you're talking about certain areas like in Indonesia or Philippines, where you have a tremendous number of islands, it's in those areas that can't get us access as well.
That's it. And, you know, we can try to predict one way or the other when that access is going to show up. You know, there are things like Starlink that are now floating around the earth. Sometimes here in Nova Scotia, if you look out the right direction over St. Margaret's Bay, you can see Starlink coming up over the horizon in a clear night sky. When I first saw it, I thought, oh, this is the invasion. It you know, it's over. But, you know, someone said, no, that's just Starlink. You're good. But the promise with that, of course, is that it's going to increase this connectivity. So is there, you know, you've got so much experience, Evan, in international development, and especially with knowledge of Canadian institutions and what they're doing. Is this on the radar of development institutions and organizations of trying to offer some sort of either technical or professional assistance in developing this capacity?
Well, I think it's on the radar, but I think we're always in catch-up mode. And I think for development professionals, especially people coming out of the universities and so forth, there's still a lot more that can be done. It's you know, the transformation process is not just, as you say, the platforms itself, whether Facebook, Meta, or whatever. And as we have just seen over the past couple days on TV, where U.S. legislators have been grilling Mark Zuckerberg and others, largely with respect to content and access to content. I mean, this raises, I think, in a very appropriate way, just the issues of inclusion and social protection and so forth. But having said that, in the developing countries where, you know, this has expanded really quickly through mobile phones and so forth, there's great opportunities to turn this into a development process, but also great challenges. And I think one of the major challenges that I think those working in international development who have always been looking at, you know, empowering local communities, is really to build the capacity in local communities to use it creatively for their own development process. You know, platforms themselves, whether it's Facebook or you know, whatever, they're very, very powerful and have inherent biases. So within the international development sector, I think it means involving local communities, not just as takers, but also in the design and implementation of their own digital solutions. And one may call this community-based digital transformation. I say that because I was involved in piece of work years ago on community-based monitoring systems for communities to be able to monitor their own development processes and so forth and to document it. But the digital transformation has transformed that process. And I think it's an interesting way to look at it. And I think now on with development agencies looking at going beyond and looking at how to work and to promote development in the most marginalized areas, this really has to be done with a very strategic viewpoint.
That's right. And there's certainly some big challenges in that equation. I mean, digital, I guess I should say data governance is one issue that can come into it. We see that, you know, take a trip over to Europe and anytime you're on any website, you know, you're to permissions. Do you want the cookies? Do you want this? Do you want that? And, you know, you come into to North America, that goes away. But then, you know, there's other things right now. I mean, in Canada, you know, all of our media outlets are effectively banned on Meta, but yet you can view them in the States. It's internationally. It's a bizarre thing. And now we've also got kind of a lot of hype, shall we say, about AI influencing this as well. And what a time for, you know, a digital transformation to occur that could be impacting almost half of humanity at the very same time that artificial intelligence is finding its way into so many sectors.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, there's a lot of misunderstanding, I think, about artificial intelligence. And I think, you know, we're getting onto that now because, you know, it's being developed as a predictive resource of responses rather than, you know, something that's really in replaces the human mind. But, you know, there's a lot of worry because it's such a disruptive force. And I think one of the main worries in developing countries is really the impact on the labor markets. And will it displace jobs to such an extent that a lot of people will be out of work, especially in the low end sectors? And I think that's an appropriate fear in some areas. But we've had those disruptors before, and I think it really needs governments and international agencies in cooperation to look at those risks very carefully and to be able to you know, not just empower local communities and with education and so forth, but also having the right policies and having the right policy mix put in place. And that's not just in terms of, you know, safety nets, but also in consumer protection and cybersecurity and data privacy. And also looking at exclusion as a result of increased market power by those who actually dominate the space. And this is really, especially with respect to small and micro-sized enterprises, which can, you know, rapidly be squeezed out of the space or be able to benefit from it.
Yeah, you know, there's a, again, just as you put that together, you know, with the education, with public education on any technology or transformative moment, it is such a challenge in many development contexts to build that trust about the value of the education of a new technology, of a new resource, of a new medical intervention, so that it builds trust locally. And what I'm thinking of in particular, and this sort of echoes back to some work that I did in my global health portfolio, when in India, we were working on some community health programs about, I guess, geez, look at that, 12 years ago. And one of the big things is that these health programs were essentially training village health workers in very, very basic skills of prenatal and postnatal care, and they had transformative impacts throughout the community. But one of the biggest things they ran up against every time when trying to expand that program was overcoming misinformation, right? There's a lot of misdiagnosis and that sort of comes in with, you know, seeking medical advice from shamanes versus from physicians, and how to combat that was a real challenge. And what we found is that one of the best means of sort of combating misinformation, which is what is part of the package of the digital platforms today, is that people in the community were more apt to trust the medical interventions if they had access to them and if they could see the results from it. And that required that governance platform to go with it. So it wasn't just saying, hey, go see the guy in the white coat for a medical intervention or go see your midwife. No, they followed up with it. The resources were there to back that encouragement. And I think that's going to be a huge challenge for any sort of state, any sort of development program to try to combat some of these fears of digital misinformation, that they've got to have the infrastructure in the background to say, well, here's access to democratic resources. Here's access to education. Here's access to the healthcare, because without that access and that lived experience, that misinformation can just flourish.
I'm glad you raised that. That's really, really important on a couple fronts. The misinformation and disinformation issue is global, obviously, and it impacts all of our lives in many ways in terms of getting access to what we think is correct information and so forth. I think at the really in some of the local communities, it's not just the blending, but it's also empowering those communities to use local knowledge as well. Mm-hmm. And this is something that often gets misplaced. I think being able to utilize information technologies, because we're talking about information, we're talking about data, in such a way that we can capture local knowledge is extremely important as well. I mean, you mentioned about the global health program that you had in India and utilizing that in a correct way, I think is critically important. But it also comes back to something even broader. And I think, cooperation, so that, the communities can capture the benefits of the digital economy, and that it doesn't become a means to capture rents through misuse of power and through misuse of information. I think, one of the most critical dimensions that I think the global international development community is facing at the moment. And that includes, that comes back to the ethical issues in terms of misuse of digital platforms. We know that very well and how to counter that. So that comes back to the basic premise of digital education and so forth. Let me just say that, with respect to that, I think that digitalization, in international development really needs now to be at the front, left, and center in all the programming with a view to, to empowering, those communities. And that, I think a lot of development organizations see digital technologies as a tool in the development toolbox rather than the box itself. It's really the box itself now, and not just a tool in the box. And so that means a lot of that means different training even for development workers to understand the impact of this.
Exactly. And I'm thinking, just as our time's kind of wrapping up here, these are some of the, there's only really a taste of the topics that we're gonna see covered by the conference that CADIP is putting on at the Norman Patterson School of International Affairs on February 21st, I guess it's 20th to the 22nd. I think on your panel, you've got folks like Dr. Fernando Perini, who's a team leader for the education and science at Canada's International Development Research Center, that's IDRC. You've got Professor Jeremy DeBeer, who's professor in the Faculty of Law at University of Ottawa, and also Maëline Bordelot, who is a program officer for democratic and inclusive governance at IDRC. So I think if anyone has the chance to be in earshot in Ottawa that time, like I say, it's in person. It'd be worth attending this.
Yes, and that's going to be also recorded. And I think all of the sessions will be recorded, but it will be useful to capture that. AI is going to be part of that discussion, and I think that's really on the forefront of many people's minds and how AI just changes the whole equation in the future. And that, of course, having a law professor involved in the discussions here, I think is very, very important because of just what you had mentioned earlier, the governance angle. If we look at data governance, really you can divide it into three big regions where Europe, and you experience that as a very, is very oriented towards data protection and for personal protection. Whereas within the US, it's much more open. They do not, I think there's a movement on behalf of the companies to limit data localization. Whereas China, where I've worked, of course, there's many firewalls because this is seen as a public good, and public security is first and foremost in their minds. But just coming back to the whole digitalization process and digital technologies and so forth, I think looking at AI and some of these new interventions as public goods really means that as a public good, there's a requirement, there's an obligation for governments and for representatives to really cooperate and to take this up and to move ahead in terms of the governance in this sector move ahead more robustly.
Well, I think that's a great point of discussion for the future on that, Evan. And I just want to thank you so much for joining us today on GDP. It's great to have you here as a board member of KDIP, and your insights on this are certainly welcome. Hopefully down the road we'll have you back again, if not some of your other colleagues, to join us to discuss these unfolding and challenging issues in global development. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Paul.